We've been in this series this summer that we are calling Sunday School Stories. And you see our great piece of technology, because this is what I had when I grew up, flannel graph. And as I sat in Sunday school growing up, I can remember hearing all the familiar stories of the Bible. And we've already hit so many of them already this summer, like Jonah and Moses and the feeding of the 5,000, and we've looked at Stephen and some others. And today we come to one of my favorites. It is one of my favorites because it's an individual that in the Old Testament had more written about him in the Old Testament than anyone else. There's no more written about anyone than this individual. But then when you look to the New Testament, there's a verse in the book of Acts that refers to this individual, and it says something about this individual that is not said about anyone else. And it's fascinating to me, and it's a challenge to me, because I wonder how this individual got such a designation. And that's what I want to talk to you about today, is I want us to look at the life of David. And when we're first introduced to David, he's a young boy. What's happening in the nation of Israel at the time is they have a king, and the king's name is Saul. But Saul is not following God. Saul is doing his own thing. He's being disobedient to what God wants him to do. And there comes a point in his reign where God says, enough is enough. I'm rejecting you as king. And in doing so, unlike normal monarchies that extend on through the generations, so your son becomes the next king, God says, no, that's not going to happen with you, Saul. We're stopping with you, and I'm going a different direction. And so we find out that Samuel, God's prophet, is sent to a small insignificant town called Bethlehem to meet a man named Jesse who has seven sons. And in doing so, God says, I'm going to name one of Jesse's sons king. Well, one by one, Jesse's sons are paraded in front of Samuel. And Samuel's looking for, okay, who is this going to be? But he's using a very worldly standard to say, what does the next king look like? So in that culture, it was very common. Most of the blessing and most of the inheritance and most of the rights went to the firstborn son. And so the firstborn son of Jesse comes out, and Samuel sees him. He's tall, good-looking guy, and he's like, this is our guy. And God speaks to Samuel in that moment, and he says, no, that's not right. This is not the one I've picked. In fact, God makes this statement to Samuel. He says, Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. One by one, all seven of Jesse's sons come before Samuel, and each one is rejected. And there's an eighth son that's not there. He's the youngest, and he's out tending the sheep. And Samuel looks, and he's like, do you have any more? There's got to be somebody else. And Jesse says, yeah, I've got one more son. It's David. He's out tending the sheep. And he said, Samuel, go get him. As soon as David gets to Samuel, Samuel knows this is God's anointed king. This is the one that God has picked. And so he does what he was supposed to do. He takes the oil, he anoints David's head with oil, and in that moment, David is now the new king of Israel. But it wasn't going to happen that way, that quickly, because there was still a king on the throne that had to be dealt with. And in doing so, David didn't get to become king right away. He had to wait. He had to exercise some patience. And even though he was anointed king and ready to be the successor to Saul, he ends up going to work for Saul instead. We read in the Bible that Saul has some kind of problem. He's tormented, it says. And this torment, the only thing that will soothe him is music. And this is where we see that David is a talented and accomplished musician. He knows how to play the lyre. And so he's employed by Saul to come in and play music to help him when he gets these headaches or whatever it is. We don't really know. It says he's just tormented by a spirit. And David helps him through that. Now think about that. David's been anointed king and his rightful place is on the throne, and yet he has to subject himself continually to really what we'll find is a pretty mad king. It's in this time also, though, that we come to one of the most famous stories about David that we have in all the Bible. David goes to visit his brothers one day who are warriors, who are fighting men, and he finds out that Israel's fighting the Philistines. And instead of going at it and everybody fighting everybody, they decide that we're going to elect a person from each group, and those two will fight, and whoever wins is the winner. And so the Philistines, they pick their guy, and he's a giant. He's 9 feet tall, and his name is Goliath. And Goliath, I'm assuming because he's big and nobody's ever picked on him in his life, he loves to trash talk. And so he does that. He's coming out, and he's like, who's going to fight me, you big, weak chickens? Come on, let's get this over with. Let's go. And he's right, though, because the Israelites are just cowering in fear. They're unwilling to go up against him. Well, David hears this take place one day, and David, probably a little overzealous in his retort, is kind of like, what's wrong with you guys? Let's go. And they're like, shh, David, shut up. That's what his brothers are telling him, right? You don't know what you're talking about. You're dumb. You're young. You don't have a clue. Shh. But he says, this guy's insulting God. We're the people of God. How could we sit here and let this guy trash talk us when we can defend God and we can go out and do this? Well, David makes such a stir that finally they're like, okay. And they're going to let him go out and fight. And he says, I can do this. And so he does, with all the bravery and courage that he can muster, he decides to go out there. And he goes to meet Goliath with nothing more than a sling and some stones. As he approaches to Goliath, Goliath is like insulted and starts mocking David. And he's like, who am I that you come at me with this dog? I mean, what are you doing? I deserve much more respect than this. And David looks at him undeterred. And he looks at Goliath and he says, you come at me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty. And David takes out a stone and he puts it in that sling and he spins it around. And that stone nails Goliath in the head. And Goliath comes tumbling down. David rushes over, takes out his spear, and cuts off his head. And he's got the victory. And the Philistines are all confused, and how did their guy lose? And they start running away, and the Israelites run after them. But David has brought the victory. Now, what I didn't tell you is that Saul knows that he's been rejected by God. And he's figured out by this point that it's David that it's going to replace him. And all through this time, he begins to get a little jealous. He begins to get a little concerned about his position. And so he doesn't look at David as a friend. He looks at David as an enemy to be defeated. And it's not helped by the fact that David is rising in popularity. I mean, the people are singing songs. After this, the people are going around singing songs saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his tens of thousands. And so as you can imagine, hearing those words being sung by the crowd would have a hard effect on you. And so Saul begins to say, okay, we've got to do something about this. I've got to take this little boy out. And so he begins to pursue David. He begins to run after him with the intent of killing him. But David's young. He's got some men with him, and they move from place to place, and they're able to avoid Saul. But David's men get a little restless, and they are after David. They're telling David, you know what, David, you need to kill this guy. You're the anointed king now. You're the one that should be on the throne. Just take care of this problem. And David always looks at his men, and he says, who am I to kill the anointed of the Lord? His philosophy is basically, God put Saul there. God will remove Saul, and in due time, I will be where I need to be. He has complete trust in what this process and how it's going to play out. In fact, there's an interesting story that it says one day Saul gets wind of where David is. He hears that David and his men are at a place called En-Gedi. And while they're there, Saul's like, let's go. We're going to take care of this problem. He gets his fighting men and they go out to take care of David. And David hears and he and his men go and hide in a cave. It's a great story because, as warriors often do, Saul's out there and he's like, I got to go to the bathroom. Exactly. And so Saul's like, well, there's a cave. I'll go in that cave. And it's the cave that David is hiding in, except Saul doesn't know that he's in there. Well, the men see Saul come in, and they're like, now's your chance. Take him out. Well, David sneaks up to Saul while he's kind of indisposed, and he cuts off a corner of his robe. And then he feels bad about it. And as Saul leaves the cave, we read that David goes after him and looks to Saul and says, Saul, this is to show you, you're hearing people telling you that I want you dead. It's not true. If I wanted it to happen, there were plenty of opportunities for it to. I'm not against you. And so things kind of settle down, but then they flare back up because Saul really does kind of go crazy at the end of his life. And we read in the story of Saul's life that he goes into this final battle that he wages. He gets injured, and he asked his swordsman to kill him, but his swordsman won't. And so Saul takes the sword and falls on it and dies. A little bit of turmoil when the monarch changes, but David's able to bring peace to the nation, and he establishes his rule in Jerusalem. And so David's a popular king. Things are going very well for him. Things are fine. They're going to battle and beating their enemies and all this, and things are good. And you would think of reading David's life, man, this guy's got a pretty privileged life, and he's making all the right decisions. He rescues the Ark of the Covenant and brings it back to the city, and he's dancing before the Lord, and everything's great. And then one day we read the story, though, that's another hugely popular story, that David did not go off to war like most kings did, that he decided to stay at home. And while he was at home, he's out walking on his rooftop, and he looks over to the other rooftop to see this very attractive woman who's bathing on the roof. Very curious customs, right? But instead of turning his eyes and saying, oh, I don't need to watch this, this is not good, David engages, and he allows his lust to overwhelm him. And because he's king, and mostly he can do whatever he wants to do, he calls for her. She comes, and they have an affair. Well, you'd think that's bad enough, but then she gets pregnant, and it's David's child. Well, you would think that there would be ways for a king to deal with this, so David comes up with this plan, and he's like, all right, Uriah is her husband. He's one of my fighting men. I'll give him a little vacation. I'll allow him to come home. I'll encourage him to go home and sleep with his wife, and then when she's pregnant, he'll think it's his, and everything will be great. The problem is Uriah was an incredible man of honor. And when he gets home, he refuses to go into his house and sleep in the same bed with his wife because he says, who am I to go home and enjoy this peace while everybody else is out there fighting? So he sleeps at the door of his house. Well, David, undeterred, says, all right, we got to fix this problem. So he says, I know what I'll do. I'll get him drunk, because that's the natural, logical next step, right? If I can't get you to do what I want, I'll just get you drunk. But even in this drunken state, Uriah refuses to go into the house with his wife and sleep with her. So David's in a real bind. What is he going to do? So in his sick, twisted mind in this moment, he hatches this scheme that says, the best thing I can do is I will send Uriah to the front lines. I will instruct the generals that once he's in place to pull everyone back, leaving only Uriah by himself. And when that happens, and it did, the enemy came over and he was easily killed. So David's moment of adultery leads to a moment of murder. And what's crazy about this story is that he doesn't even realize what he has done. He's just going about his life until a prophet named Nathan comes and confronts him about that sin. Nathan tells him a story. It's a sad story about sheep and a guy who doesn't have any sheep. You should read it. It's fascinating. It's a story that really pulls at David's heartstrings and makes him angry because he hears about a guy who was unjust to somebody else. And David's basically like, that guy should die. And at the end of the story, Nathan looks at him. He says, but you're that man. And in that moment, David has just this complete breakdown where he understands what he's done. He recognizes the seriousness of his sin and he repents and he turns back to God. You read the rest of David's life, there's a lot of craziness going on. You got kids that aren't getting along. There's a ton of family turmoil. His son Absalom tries to dethrone him and take over the kingdom, and instead of fighting him, he runs away. David runs away. And then finally, Absalom dies, so David's able to come back. And the last part of his life, there's really, you don't have a lot of those Sunday school story moments. It's just kind of like he exists and he dies. But there is one interesting thing, that as he's king, he does want to build a temple for God. At that point, people worshiped at the Ark, or in the tabernacle, which was basically a tent. And David says, how can I live in a royal palace and God have a tent? So he says, God, I'm going to build you a temple. Except God looks at him and says, no, you're not the one to do that. And David says, okay, if you don't think I'm the right one, I won't do it. And God in that moment tells him, he says, but I tell you what I will do. I will make your lineage an everlasting lineage of royalty, that your kingdom will never end. And what we find from David as you fast forward to the New Testament is he is in the line of Jesus. It's a fascinating story. David is fascinating to me because his life is one of incredible confidence, incredible courage, incredible faith, and incredible sin. It's fascinating to me that you have such an incredible person who is able to do such stupid things and sin in such incredible ways. What's even more fascinating to me is that when we get to the book of Acts in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul is preaching a sermon, and sometimes like they did, he would refer back to Israel's history. And in doing so, he brings up David and Saul. And listen to what Paul says in this message. In Acts 13, Paul says, then the people asked for a king and gave them Saul, and God gave them Saul, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, and he ruled 40 years. After removing Saul, he made David their king. God testified concerning him, I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do. What has always been curious to me is how even though his highs have been very high, his lows and his sin was very deep, how in the world would somebody with such a story like that, how could they be called a man after God's own heart? And even more importantly, I think if it can be said of David, is it possible that even with David's missteps and failures and shortcomings, is this something that could be said about you and me? Could that expression, a man after God's own heart or a woman after God's own heart, be something that God could apply to us? You know, when I hear that phrase, man after God's own heart, it brings to mind some things automatically that I think probably must be there in order for that person to qualify for that. Unfortunately, I think many of the things I consider are not correct. Because when I think, what does a man after God's own heart look like? I immediately think of someone like a Mother Teresa type, somebody who's perfect, somebody who has their life all together, somebody who never sins, somebody who looks good on the outside, somebody who's doing all the right things, somebody we might even say is a goody two-shoes. I mean, they've got it all together, the perfect life, the perfect family, the perfect job. They do all the right things. They never do any of the wrong things. And they look the part. They even the appearance looks the same. They're probably also somebody I think would maybe be overtly religious or very highly religious. You know, if they're involved in a church and they're serving on every team and they're there every time the doors are open and they're giving above 10% of their income, I mean, that's probably what we would say is a person after God's own heart. And yet, when we take our list and we stack it up next to David, we don't see a lot of overlap. David was certainly not who anyone in his culture would have picked to be a man after God's own heart. He was an insignificant nobody. The youngest in a culture where the oldest was given priority. He seemed weak in the face of not assuming the throne or taking the throne from Saul or when Absalom tried to dethrone him. He had family drama and allowed his lust to get the better of him. In fact, I thought this week, I thought, you know, if I was not your pastor and we had a pastor search committee, I doubt anyone would give David's resume a second look. Right? I mean, he would probably be, oh, adulterer? That's a big check, not. And then murderer? Oh, yeah, we're going to put this in the do not call pile, right? I mean, isn't that how we would evaluate it? But I don't know about you, but when I think about that title or that phrase, a man after God's own heart, that to me becomes one of the highest compliments that someone could ever be paid in the Bible. So what does David have that we need to be paying attention to? What is it about him that gets him that recognition in the Bible? Well, I think there's several things, four or five different traits that I think are significant as we look at David's life. But it has to begin with obedience. Obedience. Even in the Acts passage, as they're talking about David as a man after God's own heart, it concludes by saying he will do everything I want him to do. He was so focused on God and God's will and God's plan that he was willing to surrender himself completely to God's design and desire. He never took the reins and said, "No, God, I'm going to do this. I don't care what you want. This is my plan." He was obedient. And when you read about his life, you find that David was always inquiring of the Lord. He was always asking God, "God, should I do this? Should I go to war with these people? Should I go fight here? Should I do this? Should I build the temple?" He was always asking God. And not only that, but he was an avid reader and student of God's word, of the law that God had given. And what's amazing is so much is written about David in the Old Testament, but so much of the Old Testament is written by David, that we get insight into the heart, the character, the nature of who he really was. In fact, out of the 150 Psalms in the Old Testament, 73 are attributed to David. Isn't that fascinating? And when you look at him and you think, well, what motivated David? You come to a psalm like Psalm 19, where David writes these words. He says, "The law of the Lord is perfect. It refreshes my soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart." I mean, how many times do we think that? Do we look at the scripture and we say, "Oh, I'm going to read the Bible because, man, it gives me life." So a lot of times we read it, we go, "I have to read it because that's what good Christians do, and it's expected." But David looks at the law of the Lord and he says, "Man, this brings me life. It fills my soul." And it led him to a place where he knew how to live in God's will, to walk in the way that God wanted, to live in that surrendered position. He knew God. He knew the voice of God. And when God spoke, he obeyed. In fact, when you look and you do a comparison between Saul, King Saul, and King David, it's fascinating to see the contrast, because obedience is what tripped Saul up. It's what took him to the place where God said, "Okay, Saul, your heart's not right. I'm rejecting you as king." And it's what gets David the designation of being after God's own heart. I mean, even when David wanted to build the temple of God, which many of us would have said, that's an admirable goal. Why wouldn't that be a great thing for him to do? And God says, "No." David could have said, "I'm the king. I'll do what I want. I'm going to push forward, God. I'm building you a temple whether you want it or not." But we don't find that he did that. Because of this surrendered heart towards God, when God said no, David said, "Okay." Because of his obedience, David wanted what God wanted. God's will was David's will. To be a man or woman after God's own heart, it always is going to begin with obedience to God. Even Jesus himself in John 14, 23 said this. He said, "Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching." But you know what? Obedience is difficult for us, isn't it? To surrender ourselves, our will, our desires. In fact, it's kind of a funny joke, mostly true in the office, that Ryan says, if you want Brent to do something, tell him he can't, because that's a surefire way that he'll do it. I have a rebellious streak in me. You should know that about your pastor. I don't like people telling me I can't do things. I don't like to submit. I don't like to be under authority. It's just my nature. I think it's some weird middle child thing that I just have growing up. I'll blame my parents. Isn't that what we do? It's their fault that I'm the way I am. But I think it's not just me that applies to. That when it comes to surrender and following and obeying, we really resist. We really want to push back. And we tell ourselves that true freedom is found in the absence of any restraints or being under any authority. But what we find is that real freedom, true freedom, can only be found under authority when we surrender to God and obey Him. Now, when we think about David's obedience, it's very quickly, though, that we see that he wasn't 100% obedient. which I have to admit gives me a little problem. Because I think, well, I've just said he's obedience, and that's what gets you classified as a man or a woman after God's own heart. But we go back to the story of Bathsheba, and that certainly wasn't God's will. That certainly wasn't God's design. He wasn't listening to the voice of God when that took place. So there were times in his life of disobedience. So how does this play in with obedience and getting this designation of a man after God's own heart? Well, I think it leads me to the second and third qualities, I think, that are so significant in him, and that is humility and repentance. When confronted, let me back up. We want to look at being a person after God's own heart and assume that that means perfection, that it's always doing the right thing all the time, never having a misstep, never messing up at all, ever. But what David shows us is that that's not possible. That you can know God's law and you can study God's law, but occasionally your flesh may overwhelm you and may lead you down paths that you don't need to go. So it's the humility and the repentance, I think, that comes into play here that keeps you after God's own heart. What do I mean? Well, when David was confronted with his sin, he didn't make excuses. He owned his stuff. Now see, this is my pet peeve in the Clark house, is when I catch my kids in something and I know that they've done it and they immediately try to lay blame at somebody else. That, I hate that. I tell my kids all the time, if you're big enough to do it, you're big enough to own it. Own your stuff. That's the rule. And when we look at David, when he was confronted face to face with how evil and dastardly his deed was, he didn't look and he didn't say, well, it's her fault. I mean, what woman goes bathing in the middle of the day when the king's on his roof? If she hadn't been out there, I couldn't have done it. And hey, after all, I'm a guy. And you know how guys are. We look and we're stimulated visually. And you created me this way, God, so it's not my fault. And when I say some of those excuses and try to pass some of that blame, you know what I find? I find that many times we use a lot of those same excuses when we're caught in our own failures, when we're caught in our own sin, we immediately look to say, who can I blame? Who can I pin this on so that it doesn't fall on me? And yet with David, we find just the opposite. We find a man who is broken, who is crushed to the point of repentance. How do I know? Because we go to things like Psalm 51. And listen to how he writes this. And this was what this he wrote this after being confronted by Nathan. And he says things like this: have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. Blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. You see a man here, he's not laying blame anywhere else but himself. And he says, I did it. I know I did it. And then he says, God, cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquity. And then he cries out to God and he says, create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Don't cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me, God, the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. And then he looks down and he says, you don't delight in sacrifice or I would bring it. Think about what David is saying. In a time where a system of sacrifices were critical to worship, he says, that is worthless. That means nothing. But if you liked it, God, I would bring it. But you don't take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, to you is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. Because God, you will not despise. He didn't try to pass the blame off. He didn't try to say it's somebody else's fault. He didn't even say, I can do what I want because I'm king and I can write the rules if I want to. He owned it. And in humility, he repented. He was willing to come to God just saying, I have nothing to offer, but God, I throw myself on your mercy. leads me to another characteristic we see. Because to write something like Psalm 51, to pour your heart out in that way, shows that there was a very realness to David. He was very authentic, very real. He didn't try to wear a mask. He didn't try to sugarcoat things when life got difficult. He cried out to God. And when he was sorrowful, we get Psalm 51. And when he was angry, we get some of my favorite psalms, like Psalms 58, which are the imprecatory psalms. And I think it's amazing because even then we see that David would write things like this: "Break their teeth, O God." What I love about that, in my Bible, it says, "Sung to the tune of Do Not Destroy." And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be amazing to like show up on a Sunday and be like, "Break their teeth, oh God." I mean, nothing really brings you into the presence of God like that, right? But yet, we find that David pours out his heart, whether it's sorrow or joy or thanksgiving or anger, whatever. All these things are captured in the Psalms, and not once do we find that God says, "David, that's enough. Put a wrap on it. Put a face on it that looks decent and quit acting this way." No, because to be a man or a woman after God's own heart says we move beyond this facade of what we think it means to be righteous, to what it means to be a Christ follower, and it means just being real before God and being real with one another. And boy, doesn't that convict when we think in order to be real, there has to be some transparency, and we have to allow people in to see the real us. I mean, how many of us would be willing to write some of the things that David wrote in the Psalms, to bear our hearts in such a raw and honest way? And yet David did, for all of us to see. And his authenticity wasn't a weakness, but was to his credit. God didn't require a mask, and he doesn't require a mask of us that says, "Oh no, everything's fine," and we paste on a fake smile. David was real. He was real with his struggles. He was real with his flaws. He was real all the way around. And not one of these things disqualified him from being after God's own heart. And finally, I think the characteristic we see is that he had faith and trust in God. Deep faith and deep trust in God. Whether it was facing Goliath, whether it was waiting to ascend to the throne, running from Saul, it didn't matter. David trusted God. He had absolute faith in him. And his faith in God led him to a place where he no longer depended upon himself, but he was God-reliant versus self-reliant. I think that's what we see when we look at David's life and we try to pick out and say, what was it about him that qualified him for such a special honor of being called a man after God's own heart? I think David, for me, highlights one of the fundamental questions that most people ask in life. And it's this question here: where do I stand with God? You ever asked yourself that question? Where do I stand with God? Is God pleased with me? Have I done enough for God to be happy with my life? Don't we all really secretly want to know that answer? Thinking that, well, am I good enough or am I not? And what we see through David's life is that all along, God wasn't interested nearly as much in what he did as who he was at his core and the heart that was driving the man. What David reveals to us and to me is that you and me, we can have this set of us. We can be men or women after God's own heart. It's not a status reserved for the perfect, the saints, the pastors, the missionaries. It's something that can be said of everyone who follows Christ. But we have to realize it's something that doesn't happen automatically. We have to be intentional about it. We have to look deep within to see what lives in the deep, dark recesses of our hearts. Introspection is never fun. I don't sign up for it usually. In fact, I'd rather go watch something on Netflix than sit around and think, "Oh, Brent, how are you doing in your relationship with God?" But occasionally, often, we need to make that pause in our life to sit and evaluate and say, "Where am I with God?" And as we look at the life of David, we can use those things that we've talked about to kind of gauge, how are we doing? How is my obedience right now? Is God calling me to do or be something? Am I willing to submit regardless, or am I pushing my own agenda, my own will, my own way because I'd rather do that? How am I doing with humility? I'll tell you, I'm doing great. I'm the most humble person I know. Seeing who's still with me. You know, humility. In a culture that tells you to assert yourself and take care of number one, how's your humility? And what happens when you're confronted with sin in your life? When you see things and you feel the guilt or the conviction of that conversation where you said something you wish you hadn't, or you thought, you know, you did something you shouldn't have done, driving home in rush hour. What happens? Do we lay the blame at other people's feet, or are we repentant enough to go, God, I blew that one again, and God, I need you to forgive me and wash me clean? These are the questions. How's our faith and trust? Are we being authentic? Are we being real? These are the values, I think, that we have to look at to say, if we hope to be men or women after God's own heart, these are the things that matter the most. And as I said earlier, faith is not an individual sport. It's not meant to be you by yourself. These are questions that you should find somebody you can interact with and discuss. Maybe your spouse, maybe a Sunday school class or a discipleship group or a close friend where you can sit down and encourage one another. Hey, how are you doing in your faith? Have you had trials? Have you had some struggles that are really causing you to question? Talk about it. Be real, be honest with somebody else. The greatest damage you can do is try to do this thing on your own. This is a corporate faith. This is a community faith. And these questions will help us figure out how we're doing with God. To be a person after God's own heart, we know, has less to do with your behavior and more to do with who you are. Unfortunately, so often we try to substitute good deeds for a pure heart, but that's impossible. You can't substitute good deeds for a pure heart. What's interesting is Jesus dealt with this in his time. The religious leaders were doing everything right, but Jesus called out what was most significant when he looked at them and he said things like this: you've cleaned the outside of the cup, saying you're doing all the right things, but you hadn't paid attention to the inside. The inside of the cup is dirty. He said, you're a freshly washed tomb, but you're still a tomb full of dead men's bones. You need to pay attention to the inside. When God says that David is a man after God's own heart, he says, I see the inside of David. The outside took care of itself because David paid attention to the heart. It never works the opposite way, where we fake it till we make it. That's stupid advice. In Christianity, in faith, we have to have the faith first. We have to have the love of God first, the humility first, and then the life begins to reflect it. And that's what we see of David. I hope today you see that this phrase, a man or a woman after God's own heart, it's not an unobtainable designation. In fact, it can be said about each of you. What's amazing about David is who God uses to accomplish his will and his purpose, and many times it's not who we think it should be. But what we see from David is maybe it could be even you to achieve God's purpose.